Osho, Sufis, the People of the Past, Volume 2. Talks on Sufism given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 8.
The first question. Every time I fall in love, things start to crash all around me. I guess that I lose my center. But in this state, I don't know if I have a center or not. Things get confused and crazy. The question is from Krishna Priya. First thing, you don't have yet a center. That which you feel as a center is just the ego. It is not your true center. It is a pseudo feeling. It is very illusory. So when you fall in love, ego has to disappear. In love, the ego cannot exist. Love is something far more truer, far more authentic than you are. That's why you will always feel things start getting a little bit crazy, because you cannot control them. The controller is no more. When the ego is not there, who is there to control and discipline? Then you are in a chaos. But that chaos is far more beautiful than the ugly ego. Out of that chaos are born all the stars. Out of that chaos you are born anew. It is a rebirth. Each love affair is a new birth. So don't take it negatively. Don't think that you are losing something in love. You have nothing to lose. If you had something to lose, then there is no way to lose it. If you had the real center, then love supports that real center, integrates it, makes it more crystallized. Truth helps truth. For example, if in the room there is darkness and you bring a lamp, the darkness is dispelled. But if there was light, one lamp was already in the room, you bring another lamp, then the room has more light than before. The light is doubled. The ego is like darkness, a false entity, only appears to be there, but has no positive reality. When the light of love comes, darkness goes out. If you have the real center, what Gurdjieff calls crystallization, or what Hindus call Atman, or what Sufis call Ruh, Spirit. If you really have it, then each love will make it more and more clear, more and more transparent, more and more available. Each love affair will be a step, and you will be moving higher in crystallization. So this is the first thing to be understood. Don't choose the ego, choose always love. When it is a question of choosing between unreal and real, choose the real. Even if sometimes the real brings inconvenience, it brings. We have chosen the unreal because it is convenient. For no other reason we have chosen the unreal. Just for one reason, that it is convenient. You will have to go through inconvenience. That inconvenience is what I call tapas. brahmacharya, austerity, sadhana. That's what it means to be initiated in a path. Always choose the real. Howsoever harsh and howsoever painful and howsoever destructive it looks, even if it feels like death, choose it. And you will be benefited by it. Never choose the convenient, comfortable, the bourgeois. Otherwise, you will live a life either of a hostile, if you are fortunate. If not so fortunate, then the life of a phony, or if you are not fortunate at all, then the life of a zombie. Love brings you out of your ego, out of your past, out of your patterned life. Hence it appears like a confusion. Priya's observation is right. She says, every time I fall in love, things start to crash all around me. She really falls in love. I have been watching her love affairs. When she falls, she really falls. It is never so-so. It is never lukewarm. She really goes mad, berserk. And it is happening again. That's why she has put this question. But that's good. Nothing to be worried about. Lose the ego. Sometimes to be mad is the best basic necessity to remain sane. If you are always sane, then your sanity is suspect. Then you must be carrying great neurosis hidden behind you, and any day it can explode. It can erupt. You are sitting on a volcano. It is good to have few holidays from sanity. Sunday is good. Sometimes forget all about your sanity, all about your rules, discipline, controlled behavior and all that nonsense. Sometimes be on a holiday, relax and go berserk. If you go berserk deliberately, consciously, fully aware, it is going to be an incredible experience. And you are never in danger. When you go consciously, you can come back. You know the way, how you entered into it, and you know how to get out of it. When you don't go consciously, when you are thrown by a volcano inside you, when it is not your choice, but just an accident. Not that you have chosen the holiday, but you have been forced to go on a holiday. Then it is not within your capacity to come back. That's what happens to mad people. They become mad only when they have accumulated so much madness that now it is not possible for them to control it. It overwhelms them. But then they cannot come back. Here, living with me, I am teaching you one basic principle of remaining sane, and that is deliberately, consciously, with effort, sometimes go mad. It is good experience. You remain available to both the polarities, sanity, insanity. You swing. You have freedom. The person who is always sane is not free. And the person who is always insane is not free either. But the person who can sing from sanity to insanity and can easily sing smoothly with no barriers has great freedom. And these are the people who have known what life is. All the mystics are mad. And all the mad people could have become mystics, but they missed. And when you go on your own, you can come back. That's my basic teaching here. I teach you to be mad consciously. So Priya, go into it. Don't be afraid. All that you lose is not worth keeping. The second thing, she says, I guess that I lose my center, but in that state, I don't know if I have a center or not. That too is a good observation. You don't have yet. The ego has to go utterly. Only then the real center will be seen. When the clouds have disappeared, you will see the sun. Only after you have moved in deep love and ego has really been dropped, because there is something so valuable and it can be got only if you drop the ego. That price has to be paid. When you have really loved deeply, then a new kind of integration will arise in you. The love does two things. First, it takes the ego away, and then it gives you the center. Love is great alchemy. There are three kinds of love. I call love one, love two, love three. The first love is object oriented. Object of love. You see a beautiful woman, really graceful, with a proportionate body. You are thrilled. You think you are falling in love. Love has arisen in you because the woman is beautiful, because the woman is nice, because the woman is good. Something from the object has stirred love in you. You are not really the master of it. The love is coming from the outside. You may be a very unloving person. You may not have the quality of love at all. You may not have that benediction. But because the woman is beautiful, you think love is arising in you. It is object-oriented. This is the ordinary love. This is what is known as eros. It is lust. How to possess this beautiful object? How to exploit this beautiful object? How to make her your own? But remember, if the woman is beautiful, she is not only beautiful for you. She is beautiful for many. So there will be many people falling in love with her. And there is going to be great jealousy, competition, and all kinds of uglinesses that come in love, in so-called love. Mulla Nasruddin married a very ugly woman, the ugliest possible. Naturally, the friends were puzzled, and they asked Mulla, you have money, you have prestige, you could have got any beautiful woman that you wanted. Why you have chosen this ugly woman? He said, there is a reason in it. I will never suffer from jealousy. This woman will always be faithful to me. I cannot believe anybody falling in love with her. In fact, even I am not in love with her. It is impossible. So I know nobody can love her. In Mohandas, this is a tradition that when the first time the wife comes, she asks the husband, because the Mohandan woman has to remain behind parda, behind a curtain. She cannot show her face to everybody. So the woman asked the husband, whom I can show my face and whom I am not allowed. So when the woman asked Mullah, whom I can show my face and whom I am not allowed, Mullah said, you can show to everybody except to me. Now, if you are falling in love with a beautiful woman or a beautiful man, you are getting into troubles. There is going to be jealousy. There is going to be violence. There is going to be murder. There is going to be something. You are in trouble. And from the very beginning you will start suggesting so that there is no possibility of anything going wrong or beyond your control. You will start destroying the woman or the man. You will stop giving freedom. You will encroach the woman from all sides and close all the doors. Now, the woman was beautiful because she was free. Freedom is such an ingredient in beauty that when you see a bird on wing in the sky, it is one kind of bird. You may see the same bird in a cage, it is no more the same. The bird on the wing in the sky has a beauty of its own. It is alive. It is free. The whole sky is his. The same bird in a cage is ugly. The freedom is gone. The sky is gone. Those wings are just meaningless now. Kind of burden. They remind of the past and they create misery. Now this is not the same bird. When you fall in love with a woman, when she was free, you had fallen in love with freedom. Now you bring her home. You destroy all possibilities of her being free. But in that very destruction, you are destroying the beauty. Then one day suddenly you find that you don't love the woman at all because she is no more beautiful. This happens every time. Then you start searching for another woman and you don't look what has happened. You don't look in the mechanism how you destroyed the beauty of the woman. This is the first kind of love, love one. Beware of it. It is not much value. It is not much significant. It has no value. And if you are not aware, you will remain trapped in love first. Love second is, the object is not important, but your subjectivity. You are loving. So you bestow your love on somebody. But love is your quality, not object-oriented. but the subject is overflowing with the quality of love. Your very being is loving. Even if you are alone, you are loving. Love is a kind of flavor to your being. When you fall in love, the second kind of love, there is going to be greater joy than the first. And you will know. Because this love will know how to keep the other free. Love means to give all that is beautiful to the beloved. Freedom is the most beautiful, the most cherished goal of human consciousness. How can you take it away? If you love a woman really or a man, the first present, the first gift will be the gift of freedom. How can you take it away? You are not the enemy, you are the friend. This second kind of love will not be against freedom. It will not be possessive. And you will not be worried very much that somebody else also appreciates your woman or your man. In fact, you will be happy that you have a woman others also appreciate. That you have chosen a woman others also desire. Their desire simply proves that you have chosen a diamond, a valuable being who has intrinsic value. You will not be jealous. Each time you will see somebody looking at your woman with loving eyes, you will be thrilled again. You will fall in love with your woman again through those eyes. This second kind of love will be more a friendship than a lust, and will be more enriching to your soul. Now, this second kind of love will have one more difference. In the first kind of love, the object-oriented, there will be many lovers surrounding the object and there will be fear. In the second kind of love, there will be no fear. And you will be free not to bestow your love only on your beloved, you will be free to bestow your love on many others too. In the first, the object will be one and many will be the lovers. In the second, the subject will be the one and flowing in many directions, bestowing one's love in many ways to many people. Because the more you love, the more love grows. If you love one person, then naturally your love is not very rich. If you love two, it is double rich. If you love many, or if you can love the whole humanity, or you can love even the animal kingdom, or you can love even trees, the vegetable kingdom, then your love goes on growing. And as your love grows, you grow, you expand. This is real expansion of consciousness. Drugs only give you a false idea of expansion. Love is the basic, ultimate drug that gives you the idea of real expansion. And there is a possibility. Just like Albert Schweitzer has said, reverence for life. All that lives has to be loved. Mahavira in India has said the same thing. His philosophy of ahimsa, non-violence, says love all that lives. But one man, one contemporary philosopher in America, Bugbee, has even gone a step further than Mahavir and Savitcher. He says, have reverence for things too. That is the ultimate in love. You don't only love that which lives, you love even that which is. You love the chairs. You love the pillars. You love things too. Because they are also theirs. They have also a kind of being. When one has come to this point that he loves the whole existence, irrespective of what it is, love becomes unconditional. It is turning into prayer. It is becoming a meditation. First love is good in the sense if you have lived a loveless life. It is better than no love. But the second love is far better than the first. And will have less anxiety, less anguish, and less turmoil, conflict, aggression, violence. The second kind of love will be more of a love than the first kind. It will be more pure. In the first, the lust is too much and it spoils the whole game. But even the second is not the last. There is love third. When subject and object disappear. In the first, the object is important. In the second, the subject is important. In the third, transcendence. One is neither a subject and one is not dividing reality in any way. Subject, object, knower, known, lover, loved. All division has disappeared. One is simply love. Up to the second, you are a lover. When you are a lover, something will hang around you like a boundary, like a definition. With the third, all definition disappears. There is only love. You are not. This is what Jesus means when he says God is love. Love third. If you misunderstand with first, you will never be able to interpret rightly what Jesus' meaning is. It is not even the second. It is the third. God is love. One is simply love. Not that one loves. It is not an act. It is one's very quality. It is not that in the morning you are loving and in the afternoon you are not loving. You are love. It is your estate. It is not a hall. It is a makam. You have arrived home. You have become love. Now there is no division. All duality has disappeared. The first kind of love is I-it. The other is taken as a thing. That's what Martin Buber says. I-it. The other is like a thing you have to possess. My wife, my husband, my child. And in that very possession, you kill the spirit of the other. The second kind of love, Martin Buber calls, I-thou. The other is a person. You have respect for the other. How can you possess somebody you respect? But Martin Buber stops at the second. He has no understanding about the third. Where I and thou disappear. Where there is only love. Martin Buber cannot understand Jesus. He remains a Jew. He goes up to I thou. A great step from I it to I thou. But nothing compared to the step that happens from I thou to no dualism, to Advaita, to oneness. Only love remains. Even I, thou, are a little. Tension creating phenomenon. You are separate and the beloved is separate. And all separation brings misery. Unless one becomes totally one with the beloved, with the loved one, there is bound to remain some kind of misery lurking by the sides. In the first, the misery is very clear. In the second, it is not so clear. In the first, it is very close. In the second, it is not so close. It is far away, but it is there. In the third, it is no more. So, Priya, I would like you to learn more of love. Move from first to second and keep in your consciousness the third is the goal. And don't be worried about losing yourself. Lose, because that is the only way to find yourself. The second question, it has been said, you live only once, but if you live it right, once is enough. Anurag, once is more than enough. Third question, why do you tell women sannyasins not to have babies? Because I cannot tell to men sannyasins. The fourth, when a man lives with two women at the same time, does it make any difference to his energy? Are you mad or masochistic or something? Is not one woman enough for you? I have overheard. Mullah Nasruddin's son was asking, Mullah, why the Lord does not allow a man to marry two women or more? And Mullah said, if a man cannot protect himself, the Lord protects him. Even to manage one will be difficult right now for you. The question is unsigned. The person must have been afraid to ask it. The very fear shows you have a kind of alertness that what you are asking. If you are still in love one, then you will be in great troubles. You will be disrupted, torn apart between two women. With love one, one woman is more than enough. With love two, there is no problem. But then it is not a question of two women. Then the question is not relevant about the object of love. Then it depends on you, how much love you have and how much you can share. But the questioner must be somewhere in the first kind of love, where one wants to grab as many as possible, because it is an I-it relationship. Just as you would like to have two houses, three houses, and you will like to have more money in the bank, so you want to have many more women. In the ancient days, it was the only way to know whether a man is rich or not, how many women he has. Kings used to have in hundreds. Even just 30 years before, the Nizam of Hyderabad had 500 women. In fact, he was not capable even to recognize all of the women. But it was a kind of prestige. He can afford. But women are not things. They are persons. They are souls as much as you are. The question must have been asked by a man. You would like to possess as many as you can. This very possessiveness shows an unloving heart. You must be somewhere in the first kind of love, where love is I-it relationship. Move from there. Even one woman will be enough of a misery to you. Two will be too much. But you may be a masochist, then it is a different matter altogether. A masochist is one who wants to suffer, who loves being miserable, who is happy only when he is miserable. A masochist is one who wants to torture himself. If you are a masochist, then it is okay. But to be a masochist is not a good thing. It is neurosis. You will need psychiatric treatment. But if your love has moved from the first, then the question will not be relevant at all. Then it is not a question of having two women or one. It is not a question of having at all. With the second kind of love, it is a question of being. You love. You love as many people as are available. And you love in different ways. Somebody you love as your wife, somebody you love as your friend, somebody you love as your daughter, somebody you love as your sister, somebody as your mother. And that too is possible, that you can share one kind of love with many people. But first attain to the second kind of love, then it is not a problem at all. And problems utterly disappear with the third kind of love when you are simply love. Then you can go on loving. There is no end to it. You have infinite energy. But right now, you will not be able, and never do anything beyond your capacity. Otherwise, you will become more miserable. First, learn how to love one woman. At least, learn how to love one woman. Let it become an I-thou relationship. If you create a conflict with two women around you, you will not be able to move smoothly from I-it to I-thou. The fifth question. The Bible says, wait, and everything shall be given to you. Bhagavan, what do you say? I say, wait, and if you receive, it shall surely be a miracle. Just because you wait, there is no obligation on existence part to give it to you, because you may be asking the wrong thing. And as I know people, out of 199.9% people ask, for the wrong thing. If God is compassionate, he cannot give those things to you. Your desire is your desire. It is part of your mind. It is part of your ego. God cannot fulfill it, should not fulfill it. If he fulfills it, you will be getting into more and more astray, far away. You will be moving in dark night, and you will be losing all possibilities of re-entering into the source of light. No, all your desires cannot be fulfilled. In fact, your desire as such cannot be fulfilled. Your desire is going to be a wrong desire. You are wrong. How one becomes right? There are no right desires and wrong desires. There are only right persons and wrong persons. The wrong person is the one who has desires, and the right person is one who has no desires. When there are no desires, everything is fulfilled. Now this will look like a paradox. When you don't have any desire, everything is fulfilled. Then you get that which is needed. Then you get that which is beneficious. And you are always happy, because it is always a gift. The sixth question: why do you call men monkeys? Is not it insulting to the dignity of man? Monkeys think otherwise. They also don't like to be compared with men. They think it is against the dignity of the monkeys. When Darwin said that man has come out of the monkeys, has evolved out of the monkeys, monkeys were very angry. Great treatises have been written by the monkeys, proving that man is a fall and not an evolution. And there are arguments for it, because man has fallen from the tree to the earth. It is a fall. And man has become less than he was. You ask any monkey. You just try to follow a monkey and it will be impossible. How strong a monkey is, man is no more strong. Man is almost impotent in comparison to a monkey. See the joy of the monkeys. Man is so sad. Why in the first place you should think that man's dignity is insulted or man is humiliated? Monkeys are beautiful people. Yes, I know they have not produced Buddha, Rumi, Junaid. That's true. But they have not produced Genghis Khan, Tamerlan, Alexander, Adolf Hitler either. They have not been creating wars and killing and murdering. Monkeys are vegetarians. Monkeys are very good people. And always happy, and always in the mood of fun, and always celebrating. Yes, man can rise very high, beyond humanity, but man can fall also very low. below animals. And up to now, the record of going higher than humanity is not much. Once in a while, after millions, one person rises to become a Buddha or a Junaid or a Muhammad. But the others remain lurking in the darkest, muddiest consciousness. I am reminded of a beautiful story. It just happened few months before. It happened in the election days. Few things sell very much in the election days. One of those things is the white hand-spun Gandhi cap. It sells only when there are elections. Everybody becomes a Gandhian. Once the election is over, people forget all about Gandhi. And it is good that they forget all about Gandhi. Because whatsoever he has taught is almost nonsensical. But when there is election, everybody is a Gandhian. Even those who are suspected of murdering him, even they become Gandhians. So Gandhi caps were great in demand. And a man was doing great business. He was rushing from one town to another, selling Gandhi caps. One day he was coming home from another neighboring town. He was very tired. The business has been really great. Almost 1,000 caps he had sold. Just few. 50, 60 caps were left in his bag. And he was very tired. So underneath a banyan tree, he rested for a while. He fell asleep. When he woke up, he saw the bag is empty and all the caps are gone. He could not believe because he could not see anybody around. Then he looked up and it was really a beautiful scene. All the monkeys sitting and enjoying, and they were all having Gandhi caps. You could have found Morarji Desai and Charan Singh and Jagjivan Ram, all kinds of people there. And they were really grinning and smiling. It was a trip. First the man also enjoyed, but then he thought 6 caps are gone. What to do now? How to get these caps back? Then he remembers that monkeys are imitators. Only 1 cap was on his head left. So he shouted, "Abracadabra," just to catch the attention of the monkeys, and they all looked what is going on. And he threw his cap. The moment he threw his cap, all the monkeys threw their caps. They are imitators. He collected the caps, laughed loudly, came home. Next day he had fever and could not go. So he sent his young son, but he told the story that by chance, if something like this happens, remember, first shout the mantra, "Abracadabra," and then throw your cap, and you will get all your caps back. If something like this happens, just to be safe, I am telling you. So the son went, and it was a good day, and he sold many, many caps. And when coming back, by coincidence it happened, just when he came near the banyan tree, he also felt very tired. And it was so shady and such beautiful foliage, and it was such a beautiful place to rest. So he puts his bag, goes to sleep, and when he opens his eyes, exactly it has happened. It is a miracle. The bag is empty. He looks up. Morarji Desai, Charan Singh, Jagjivan Ram, all are sitting there. All the great Gandhians. with their Gandhi caps, and they are really enjoying and thumping, and they look more hilarious than the father has told in his story. But the son was not puzzled. He knew the secret. So he shouted loudly, "Abracadabra," and threw his cap. And monkeys were almost crazy. They went crazy with laughter and shaking the tree as if it was an earthquake. And do you know what happened? One monkey who had not got a cap came down and took the cap up. They had learned a lesson. Monkeys are intelligent people. Now even the one that was left is gone. Man learns more slowly than monkeys. Man goes on repeating the same mistakes again and again. What kind of dignity you are talking about? If you look at the history of man, it is the same mistakes being repeated again and again. Almost mechanical. The same war, the same violence, the same rape on nature, the same destructiveness. Down the ages, it is the same story. Only once in a while there is an oasis in this destructive desert of so-called humanity. A Buddha, a Mansur. But they are so rare and so exceptional, they can be counted out. They need not be counted in. They are so exceptional, that's why we cannot believe that they have really existed. They look metaphors, like metaphors. They look like myths, maybe inventions of human mind, just to keep his dignity, just to keep the idea of his dignity. He has created Buddhas and Mahaviras and Krishnas and Christ. Many people suspect that they ever existed, and their suspicion has a reason. If you look around, you see the man in such a state, in such an ugly and neurotic state, it is impossible to believe that a Buddha is possible. And Buddha is such an exception, and the ordinary neurotic man is the rule. That's why people suspect that these may be wish fulfillment. That's what Sigmund Freud says. That all these great people are just wish fulfillments. Man wants to be like that. He creates mythologies. What dignity you are talking about? Without man, the earth will be far more beautiful. It will be less poisonous. The rivers will be again pure. The air will be again unpolluted. Trees will again grow. Animals will again start roaming. Birds will again fly. Do you think without man the earth will miss much? Yes, it will miss your poisoning, your pollution, your destruction, your wars, blood. It will miss these things, but it will be far more beautiful. Things will be far more silent and musical, in more harmony. And I am not saying that man has no dignity. I never agree with people like B.F. Skinner. Skinner has written a book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Man is neither free and has no dignity either. No, I'm not saying that. Man can have dignity, but one should not accept it as a given fact. It has to be created. It is potential, but not actual. It is possible, but that possibility is only a perhaps. It has not already happened. You cannot take it for granted. Just by being born as a man, you don't have any dignity. You just have the face of a man and all kinds of animality inside. You will be surprised to know the English word beast comes from a Sanskrit word pasu. On the surface they don't seem to be related at all, pasu, beast. But pasu became in Egypt past, and then it became bust, and then it became beast. And your English word bastard also comes from pasu. Bust, bust, bastard. Bastard means not knowing your father. That's the situation in animals. Who is the father? No animal can say. When a man cannot show his father, cannot identify his father, we call him a bastard. But these beast and bastard come from a Sanskrit root pasu, and pasu is tremendously important. Pasu comes from another root pas. Pas means bondage. One who is in bondage is a pasu, is an animal. One who is still in bondage of the ego, is still in the bondage of the mind, is still in the bondage of desire, lust, thoughts, is a pasu, is an animal. So man is man only on the surface. Only a Buddha is a real man in the depth. If Buddha is standing by the side of you, you both look alike. But only on the surface. Your faces resemble, but deep down you are so utterly different, so radically different. You live at the lowest rung and he lives at the highest rung. The difference is vast, almost infinite. Man has dignity in the sense that man can become a Buddha. But not just by being a man. Nobody is born as a man. Humanity has to be searched, discovered, created. So don't think that because you are born like a human animal, you are a man. No, not yet. You can become. That is your dignity, but not that you are already. That is your dignity, that is your freedom, you can choose to become or not to become. And millions choose not to become. And rarely, far and few in between, somebody chooses to become. So millions live in a kind of disgrace, in a kind of a state of sin, in a state of fallen consciousness. People live at the minimum, and unless you live at the maximum, you don't have any dignity. You can have it, but you don't have it. Strive for it. Make effort for it. Before death comes, become really a man. The seventh question. Brown has said, the ultimate problem is not guilt, but the incapacity to live. The illusion of guilt is necessary for an animal that cannot enjoy life, in order to organize a life of non-enjoyment. I will not agree. because man is born with the capacity to live. Everybody is born with the capacity to live. That's what birth means, capacity to live. Then somewhere on the way, man loses the capacity to live, becomes non-orgasmic, becomes sad, serious, dull, stupid. Each child is born intelligent, full of joy, wonders, adventures, inquiry. Each child is born open-ended. But somewhere near the age 3 and 4, between 3 and 4, the child is distracted by the society, loses all contact of his original capacities, and becomes a false entity. Up to the age 3, the child remains part of nature, flowing, happy for nothing at all, happy for no reason, just happy. Just watch a child, what he has got to be happy about? But he looks at the top of the world. For small things, he can be so happy. Just pebbles collecting on the seashore. And he can be so happy that you are never going to be. Even if you collect Kohinoor, you will not be so happy. And just pebble colored stones are rushing after a butterfly. And a child seems to be so joyous. Somewhere near the age 3, the child becomes civilized. We force him. We initiate him into civilization. And civilization up to now has been a kind of insanity, a madhouse. We force the child to become more and more intellectual and less intelligent. We force the child to become more and more prosaic and less poetic. We force the child to become more and more concerned about the non-essential, money, prestige, power, ambition, and more uninterested into the real joys of life. We turn the child from a playful being into a worker. The work ethos enters. Now duty becomes more important than love. Formality becomes more important than informal fellow. Manners become more important than truth. Policy becomes more important than authenticity. Once the child has learned these strategies, he is no more happy. And when a child is no more happy, then he needs some reason why he is unhappy. First we make him unhappy. Then naturally one day he is going to ask, why I am unhappy? Then you have to find reasons. Hindus say, because in your past life you have done bad karmas. Christians say, because of the original sin, because Adam committed a sin of disobedience to God, that's why. And so on and so forth. Now look at the whole stupidity of it. First, you destroy the capacity to enjoy. Then naturally, when the child becomes non-enjoying, he asks, why I am miserable? Why I am unhappy? Why I can't be happy? What has gone wrong? Naturally, You cannot say what has gone wrong. You may not be even aware of it. You cannot say that you have put him on the wrong track. And you may not have put him on the wrong track knowingly. You may have simply given it as a heritage. Your fathers, your society, your mothers have given it to you. You have given it to your children. Each generation gives its neurosis to the new generation. Madnesses go on living. People go on changing. Madnesses go on living. You may not be aware that each child is born with infinite potentiality to be happy. Each child is orgasmic. But one day or other he is going to ask and you have to provide answers. So you create guilt. You say, because you have committed sin in the past life, you are Adam and Eve, that doesn't matter. Anybody X, Y, Z will do. Just you have to give an explanation that something has gone wrong in the past. And past is beyond your capacity. You cannot do anything. What can I do or you do about Adam and Eve? How we can manage him not eating the apples? It is impossible. He has eaten it. It has already happened. We cannot undo it. And it is not a drama that is happening right now. One day I heard two small children, one boy and girl, brother and sister, were playing, and then the boy hit the girl very hard and she started screaming, and the mother came and the mother asked, what is the matter? Why you have hit your sister? And the boy said, we were playing Adam and Eve, and rather than giving me the apple, she ate it herself. Now this is not a drama. We cannot change it anymore. It has already happened. Adam has eaten the fruit of knowledge. You cannot do anything. You simply feel guilty. Hindus look more rational. They are. But that doesn't make much difference. Hindus say it looks absurd that for Adam's sin you will suffer. They make it more rational. They are rational people. They have been philosophizing for centuries. They say it is your past karmas. In your past life you have done wrong. Now who is going to suffer? You are going to suffer for your wrong. It looks more logical. But it is not. You go on asking a Hindu pandit, then okay, in my previous life I did something wrong. What about in my previous life also I was suffering? How back you can go? There must be first life somewhere. Why I did something wrong in my first life? Because there is no other life to precede it. So you cannot throw the responsibility on the previous life. Why it happened in the first place? It is absurd. Nobody has the answer. In fact, it has not happened in the Garden of Eden. And it has not happened in your past life. It has happened in your this life. And it has happened in your parents' house. And it has happened in your school. And it has happened in your society, in your country. And it has been done by the parents and the priest and the politician. These are the culprits. These are the criminals. They have taken your joy. And they have given you wrong things. They have taken real nutritious food from you, and they have given you lollipops. Even if it tastes good, it does not satisfy hunger. Even if it tastes good, it does not fulfill, it does not make you strong. Yes, ambition tastes good. It is a lollipop. Fame, success tastes good, but deep down you remain poor. Look at your so-called rich people. Look a little deeper in them, and they are beggars. Worse than beggars. Sometimes it is possible a beggar may have something inside him, a luminous being. And Buddha was a beggar. So was Mahavira. But look at your kings and your rich people, dull and dead. No joy surrounds them. Just they go on somehow dragging. And you have been put on the same track. Somebody is needed to take you out of this condition. That's the function of a master, to uncondition you, to take all the conditioning that your parents have given. The master is basically against your parents and against your society and against your politicians. Hence it is not accidental that politicians and the parents and the society and the priest are always against a real master whenever he happens. That is where the conflict is. That's what I am doing here. Taking your wrong conditioning so that your joy can erupt again. It is there. That spring is there. Nobody can destroy it. It is existential. It is part of your being. Nobody can take it away. Only it has been blocked. The spring is there and the fresh water is still running there. But only rocks have been put around you. You have been blocked. Once those rocks are taken away, again you will become a child. It will be a rebirth. Again you will start flowing. Again your eyes will have luster and your face will have joy. Again you will become luminous. That's what Jesus means when he goes on saying, only those who are like children will be able to enter into the kingdom of my God. You ask, Brown has said, the ultimate problem is not guilt, but the incapacity to live. Illusion of guilt is necessary for an animal that cannot enjoy life in order to organize a life of non-enjoyment. How you have been destroyed in your childhood, that has to be looked into. You were born capable of living. Everybody is born. Then your capacity to live has been taken away. And the way and the trick that has been used to take it away is to give you false ideas, pseudo ideas, to move you in directions which are futile, meaningless, to put you on tracks which go nowhere. Which always end in a cul-de-sac. And when naturally you are in a cul-de-sac and your life is not going anywhere, are running in circles, an explanation is needed. Why this happened to me? Why this happened to me and not to others? That too is in the mind of everybody, that everybody else is happy, only I am miserable. Because you look only faces. and people manage their faces. They have masks. They don't want to show their misery. What is the point? They keep it hidden. So when you look around, you may see that everybody seems to be happy, only I am miserable. And that's how everybody is thinking. That everybody else seems to be happy, only I am miserable. All are miserable. Misery is there because the society has distracted you. It is not that man is born with incapacity to live. No. That is not the problem. That's why I don't agree. The problem is not that man has no capacity to joy. Man has. The problem is that man is not allowed to grow in a natural way. There are vested interests which don't allow man to go into joyous ways. They need a miserable man. For their own purposes, the miserable man is more suitable than a happy man. Because a happy man is a rebel. And a miserable man is never a rebel. A miserable man is always ready to obey. Always ready to submit. A miserable man is so miserable that he cannot stand on his own. He knows on his own he is just miserable. So he is ready to fall in anybody's trap. Any politician can become the leader if people are miserable. Then any stupid person can become your leader, your prime minister, your president. Because he can promise you. He can promise you great things. And you are so miserable that you trust the promises. If you are happy, nobody can deceive you by promising, because you need not have any promise. You are already happy. With a happy world, politicians will disappear. When you are unhappy, you start thinking maybe this life is wasted. This life I could not manage. Even if I can manage the coming one, that is more than enough to ask. You go to the priest. The priest promises you the other life. The politician promises something good in the future, in this life. And the priest promises you something good in another life, beyond death. Both go on promising. Promises are needed by miserable people. If you are happy, you will not go to the politician and you will not go to the priest. For what? You are already happy. You are already in paradise. Then the whole profession of the priest and the politician disappears. And these are the exploiters. These are the people who are sitting on your heart and blocking your energies. They can remain in power only if you are miserable. Remember it. By being miserable, you are helping a gang of exploiters. Be happy and you bring the greatest revolution in the world. Sometimes people come to me and they ask, why don't you teach something so that the society can be changed? That's what I am doing. But I am doing it so fundamentally. I don't teach you any social revolution. I don't say to you that go and throw this government. That is meaningless. Because those who will throw the government will become your exploiters. It never changes anything. Down the ages, man has been changing the government and the social structure and the economic structure, but nothing basically ever changes. Again and again, the same thing happens. Man is caught. All hopes are hopeless. But I am doing something really revolutionary, radical, and that is I am trying to make you happy. Now it may not be very obvious to you how it is concerned with the revolution of the society. It is concerned. a happy person is beyond being oppressed, exploited. Because a happy person needs no promise. A happy person is already happy, so he is not worried about paradise or afterlife. That is all nonsense. A happy person is not worried about tomorrow. The morrow takes care of itself. Jesus says, look at the lilies in the fields. They don't think of the morrow. They don't toil. They don't labor. They live an unworried existence. They are just there. But I say unto you that even Solomon, attired in all his beautiful, valuable dresses, was not so beautiful as these flowers of lilies. That's what sannyas is all about. I would like you to become a lily, a flower, unconcerned about the future, unconcerned about the past. The past is no more and the future is not yet. Only the present is there. Bloom in it. Be happy in it. Rejoice in it. Celebrate in it. And you bring a great revolution in the world, because you will be getting out of all the traps of the priests and the politicians. The priests and politicians create guilt in you. They do the harm and then they make you feel guilty. They destroy your capacity to live, to love, to delight. And then they throw the responsibility on you. It is your sin. It is your wrongdoing that has made you so miserable. Then they create guilt. But the basic problem is conditioning. Men should be helped to live a natural life. Men should not be conditioned to live an unnatural life. The basic problem is not incapacity to live. You are born with it. The basic problem is how not to allow others to destroy that capacity. Once they destroy, then they bring guilt also in. Guilt is their protection. They protect themselves behind the garb of the guilt. First they kill you and then they make you guilty that you have committed suicide. The seventh question, why I always act out of fear? It is the same thing. Fear has been put into you very deep down. You have been made afraid. You have been frightened. You have been put into a very, very fearful state of consciousness. The child is born helpless. But the child is not fearful. Remember, he is helpless but not fearful. The child can go and play with a snake. And the child can go and try to ride on a lion. The child is not fearful. The child is helpless, that is true. He is delicate, vulnerable. He needs your help to grow. But you exploit his helplessness. You start changing the color of his helplessness. You make it, you turn it, you reduce it into fearfulness. And it is very easy to change helplessness into fearfulness. Because the child is helpless, you can always make him feel fear. You can say to him, we are not going to give you food today. or we are going to lock you in the bathroom, or we will give you a good beating if you do this, or the mother can say, I am going to leave, or I am going to renounce you, or the father can say, I will never come home if you do this again. You can make the child very afraid. He is so helpless. He cannot live without you. He does not know how to even survive without you. And it is not possible for him to survive without you. Because of this, you can exploit him. You can make him afraid. When he is afraid, then you are powerful. When he is afraid, then you know his buttons. Then you can manage whatsoever you want him to do and whatsoever you don't want him to do. Then you can force your ideas, your religions, ideologies, your patterns. You have been miserable. And you know that you have been miserable. Now you will be forcing the same thing on him and you will make him miserable. If you really love your child, one thing you will never do, you will never make him like you. But every mother and every father always wants the child to be just like him. People feel very happy. Once a child was born, the father was my colleague in the university. He invited me to see the child. He was thrilled. And he said on the way, driving me to his home, he said, somebody has said that the child looks like me. And many people are saying that he looks exactly like me. Then I went to see and I told the father that he looks like you, but please, remember not to make him like you. He said, what are you saying? What else I can do? My child has to be like me. Now this father is on a good trip as all other fathers are. Why the child has to be like you? Maybe the face looks like you, it is okay. The face does not matter. What matters is his spirit. He has his own spirit. If you try to make it like you, it will be good, a good trip for you. People try to be immortal in this way. They will be dying. Their child will live and he will be just like them. Just as fucked up as they are. Just as miserable as they are. Just as neurotic as they are. I told the father that as far as I know, you have been coming to me for many times, for many years. And you have been coming to me because you are miserable. And you want this small child to be just like you. Then he will be miserable. If you really love the child, then make a decision, an absolute decision and commitment, that one thing you will avoid, and that is that the child should not be like me. He can be anybody else. There is some chance in being anybody else of being happy, but at least one thing is certain, that if he is like me, he will be as miserable as I am. But that's what goes on. You ask me why I always act out of fear. Because you are still not free of your parents. All fear is from your parents. You may have grown in age, but you have not grown in consciousness. Drop your parents. And I am not saying anything against your parents. I have all the compassion for them. Their parents have done the same thing to them. They have suffered a lot. I am not saying be angry with them. I am saying just get rid of them. Drop the conditioning that they have put unknowingly into you. Be free of them. And then you will also have a great compassion and love for them. You will feel sorry for them. this new collection box has some new features. When you drop in a quarter or more, it does not make a sound. Drop in a dime and it tinkles like a bell. A nickel blows a whistle. And a penny fires a shot. And when you don't drop anything in, the box takes your picture. Now that's how religion creates fear in you. I have heard a minister went hunting up in the mountains. Suddenly a big deer got after him. He took off so fast you could play checkers on his coattails, but he could not find any place to hide. Suddenly he saw a tree, but the lowest limb was 20 feet from the ground. He made a frantic leap for it, but missed it. However, he grabbed it on the way down. You are full of fear. You are just fear and trembling and nothing else. And everybody else lives on your fear. So nobody is going to help you to drop it, because everybody lives on you. Your wife will not help you to drop it because she lives on it. Wives make their husbands so much afraid. Your husband will not help you to drop it. Because once you drop fear, you may drop the husband itself. It may be just because of fear you go on keeping with this ugly man. Your children will not like you to drop fear. Because you are afraid, your children have some power over you. Your parents will not like you to drop fear. Nobody will like you to drop fear. Only you have to decide. Because it is against you and in favor of all. It is destructive to you and a good opportunity for everybody to exploit you. And the last question. Beloved Bhagwan, I am suffering from writer's block. I wonder how is it that lately, as I feel more and more overwhelming gratitude and love, I become less and less able to express it. It pains me that I cannot share what I am experiencing. Your lovesick bard, Manisha. It happens, Manisha. The more you will feel for me, the more you will feel incapable to express it. Superficial feelings can be expressed easily. Words are adequate for them. Deeper feelings cannot be expressed adequately. Words are not adequate for them. Words are too superficial. When the feeling goes very deep, it goes beyond words. You can feel it. You can be thrilled by it. You can feel the pulsation all over your body and being. But you cannot put it into words. You can try and you will feel that you have failed. When you put it in words, something very tiny comes up. And it was so huge when you were experiencing it. It was so enormous. It was so overwhelming. And now you put it in a verse and it is just a drop. And it has been an ocean when you were feeling it. I can understand Manisha's problem. She is my bard. And the deeper she will go into me and into herself, the more and more it will be difficult for her. The more and more she will feel incapable. But that's a good sign. That's a sign that something really tremendous is happening. Go on trying to express, because even if it cannot be expressed, it has to be expressed. Even if you cannot put the ocean of your heart in the words, nothing to be worried. Even only few drops come in it, that is good, because even those few drops will lead people towards me. Even those few drops will give them a taste of the ocean. And remember one thing, even a single drop of the ocean is as salty as the whole ocean. And even a single drop of ocean is as much water. It may be small, but it has the same flavor. It may be very small, but it has the same secret. If you can understand a single drop of water, you have understood all the water that exists on the earth or on other planets. Even on some unknown planets, if water exists, it will be H2O. We don't know. But if on some unknown planet water exists, it will be H2O and nothing else. We know the secret. And a single drop of water has the secret. So don't be worried. The song is going to become more and more difficult. The deeper you will go, the more you will feel dumb. The deeper you will go, the more you will feel silence is needed. The more you would like to sing the song in silence. But silence will not be understood by people. And Manisha is my bard, so she cannot be allowed. So let the writer's block be there. I will go on hammering on it and destroying it. And you go on singing your song. Enough for today.